Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Wildfire on the tundra used to be very rare, and when it happened, was pretty darn small. That is clearly not the case now.
Scientists draw a direct link between climate change and the summer's largest wildfire so far. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 15th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, people leaving the state's largest homeless shelter have few places to go next.
So we don't know what that transition looks like for individuals other than they will have to go into the community unsheltered.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The Division of Elections has updated results in the special primary for U.S. House, and the finish order remains unchanged. Republican Sarah Palin dropped slightly in the latest count to 28%. Republican Nick Begich is still at 19%. Nonpartisan Al Gross rose a fraction of a point to nearly 13%. And Democrat Mary Peltola rose a point to nearly 9%. If that order holds, those four will advance to the special general ballot in August. Peltola is more than 4,000 votes ahead of the fifth-place finisher, Republican Tara Sweeney. Meanwhile, the long process of ballot counting will continue until June 21st. For Alaska's first statewide by-mail election, the state essentially used the process developed for absentee ballots. This morning at the Anchorage office of the Division of Elections, Supervisor Jeff Congdon explains how each ballot envelope is reviewed, first by an election official and then by people at the absentee review board.
There's a table of two individuals where each individual discusses each ballot as they review them, and they look at the online voter database to verify identifiers that are on the envelope. And yeah, essentially, does this look like this ballot belongs to this individual who submitted it?
After that, the ballots are brought to another room across the hall.
What's happening now is we're scanning and uploading images and getting all the information from the ballots. And then once the counting is done, those results will be sent to Juneau.
The Division of Elections expects to release updated results again on Friday. The Juneau School District is investigating how and why a dozen students were served a chemical floor sealant instead of milk. The incident happened at one of its summer school locations on Tuesday, and parents are ready for answers now. KTOO's Claire Strempel reports.
Not all of the children who drank the sealant were back in summer school on Wednesday. Donna Baldwin kept her grandson home to go see a doctor. She said she's worried about his health and upset that the school took hours to notify her. She says he drank the chemicals around 9 a.m., and she didn't get a call until the afternoon.
Well, the minute I picked him up and got him in a car, he started crying really hard.
She said he was traumatized and needed his family.
He said, am I going to die?
He told her the milk burned his throat, that his stomach hurt, and that he was dizzy. She took him to the emergency department. She says they checked his oxygen levels, which were normal.
And he's still having some issues of his throat hurting and I'm getting dizzy, and I'm very concerned somebody bring him down south.
Baldwin says she wants to be sure there's no permanent damage, so she's taking him to Seattle Children's Hospital for some follow-up tests. She's one of several parents who told KTOO they felt that calls from the school came much too late. She says the school should have notified families immediately after the incident, not hours later.
And the more I process it, the angrier I get that it wasn't immediately taken care of. If I was there, I would have called medical right away. this was minimized and it's not okay.
Superintendent Bridget Weiss says the reason it took so long to contact parents was that staff prioritized making sure the kids were safe. They called poison control and monitored the children before reaching out to parents.
This was a really unfortunate incident. We're grateful it was an isolated incident, and we're still learning some pieces of how it happened.
Weiss says the school district is investigating the issue. She says what they know so far is that boxes containing large pouches of milk and boxes containing large pouches of floor sealant were delivered to the school on the same pallet. But she said she doesn't know who was responsible for that.
That shouldn't have happened. So we don't ever transport or store chemicals with commodities, right? Those are two very separate things.
Nana Management Services is the contractor that prepares and serves food for the district. Weiss says staff mistook the sealant pouches for milk and put them in the milk dispenser.
It's a little hard to imagine unless you've used it, but many chemicals do look very much milk-like. They are white. The consistency is the same as milk.
She said that the sealant is odorless, so staff did not catch the mistake until students drank it. The school board was scheduled to vote to renew Nana Management Services' contract Tuesday night. They voted unanimously to postpone that decision. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Claire Strempel.
The East Fork Fire in western Alaska is the state's largest at the moment, estimated at more than 141,000 acres today, and it's burning in a region that just a couple decades ago, large fires would not have been expected. A major contributing factor is our warming climate, says climate specialist Rick Tolman with the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Tolman says hot, dry weather and a lightning strike at the end of May combined to make the East Fork Fire the biggest tundra fire on record by far for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region.
You know, really, prior to about 2015, there were a handful of documented wildfires on the tundra in the YK Delta, but very few. There's been a big uptick. Similarly, in Upper Bristol Bay area, the Dillingham King Salmon area, historically, there's only a relatively few number of fires. Most of them have been documented in the last decade or so, but this year we've had easily the largest wildfires, for instance, anywhere close to Dillingham. So really quite remarkable, and really a big change from what we saw even 10 or 15 years ago. We just didn't think about or really expect these kind of fires on the tundra landscape.
What even is a tundra fire? I mean, what is burning out there?
So tundra comes in many different shapes and sizes and types of vegetation. So southwest Alaska, their vegetation is much thicker, much denser. Willows and alders growing up, you know, taller than your head versus on the coastal north slope where most of the plants, you know, aren't much above your ankle. So they're both tundra, but very different environments. From wildfire perspective, of course, the more plant material you have to burn, the hotter the fire is potentially. If you've got a hotter fire burning deeper into that duff layer, the surface layer, that's going to be harder to extinguish. In tundra fires, you don't have the tree mass to burn like you do in the boreal forest. In areas where the tundra is quite thick with vegetation, there's still plenty to burn from willows and alders and through the tundra grasses as well.
How does the changing climate factor into this?
Well, our changing climate, our changing environment, of course, didn't cause the thunderstorm on May 31st that sparked the East Fork Fire. But what our warming environment does is it supports, for instance, the increased growth of plants on the tundra in southwest Alaska. And so as elders from St. Mary's and really all around western Alaska have been reporting for years that vegetation is thicker, it's growing taller. We see spruce trees are advancing into places where they didn't grow or places where trees were just very spindly and few and far between. They're getting more robust and thicker now. And all of this is the result of this long-term, decades-long warming. Spruce trees, of course, don't spread because you have one warm week. It's that sustained year after year warmer conditions that are allowing plants to grow more, grow in places they didn't before. Plants don't care how we measure anything. They just grow where they can and don't grow where they can.
Yeah. Is it fair to say that this might be the future, that we should expect that there would be these fires out in that region?
Certainly that's been the case so far. In the YK Delta, wildfire on the tundra used to be very rare, and when it happened, was pretty darn small. That is clearly not the case now. 2015, 2020, now 2022 have featured these very large fires without precedent in this part of the state. Now, of course, in the boreal forest portion of the state, fires this size happen somewhere, literally most years. But out on that tundra, where it's a cooler environment, there's less fuel to burn, fires this size didn't used to occur, and they are now. There's no reason to think that this isn't going to be a feature going forward. Of course they won't occur every year. You have to have all the weather ingredients come together as well. That is dry conditions, something to spark the fires like lightning. But when all of those pieces come together, this is the kind of thing that will result. We're seeing it now.
That was Rick Toman, a climate specialist with the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Sport Fisheries in Cook Inlet closes, king salmon populations suffer.
Ideally, I'd like to see king salmon start turning around right now, but it feels like, you know, we're in for the long haul.
That's coming up. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's unique approach to mental health funding is improving the lives of Alaskans who experience behavioral health conditions and developmental disabilities. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority has a responsibility to generate revenue from its 1 million acres of land and the resources they contain. The trust uses this revenue to help fund statewide programs and initiatives that positively impact trust beneficiaries. To learn more, visit alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
A 20-year-old Quinnahock man has received a sentence of 99 years in prison for the murder of a 10-year-old girl in the Western Alaska village. Jordan Mark pleaded guilty late last year to the March 2020 killing of Ida Gurley Aguchek. Mark had asked a judge for a sentence of 45 years, but at his sentencing Monday, Superior Court Judge Michael McDonald made a finding that Mark was to be considered a worst offender and that he was, quote, too dangerous to live in a civil society. According to a statement from the Department of Law, Aguchek's father told the judge his daughter had wanted to be a nurse someday so she could help people. While there was no trial, a state prosecutor told the judge at the Monday sentencing that Mark had tricked Aguchek into getting on his ATV, saying he would give her a ride home. Even when Aguchek tried to run away at one point, the prosecutor said, Mark caught her, sexually assaulted her, and killed her. According to the law department, the prosecutor said Mark was not amenable to rehabilitation, and Judge McDonald apparently agreed, handing down the maximum sentence allowed under state law. Anchorage homelessness advocates say they're concerned about what will happen when the mass shelter at the Sullivan Arena closes in just 2 weeks. They want to know where the people who are staying there will go. At a news conference today called by the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness, Executive Director Meg Zalatel said she hasn't gotten answers from Mayor Dave Bronson's administration. Zalatel is also an Anchorage Assembly member.
So we don't know what that transition looks like for individuals other than they will have to go into the community unsheltered.
The plan from Mayor Dave Bronson's administration to transition from the Sullivan involves a new, more permanent shelter and navigation center at the corner of Tudor and Elmore Roads. The Anchorage Assembly appropriated millions of dollars to build the new shelter, but it's still months away from completion. Zalatel says the administration hasn't been clear on how they'll provide for food, hygiene and transportation needs of people experiencing homelessness following the shuttering of the Sullivan Arena on June 30th. About 219 people are currently using the shelter. And Zalatel says there's not many other places for them to go. Places like Brother Francis Shelter and the complex care facilities are at or near capacity, with most housing programs' waiting lists full. Zalatel is also concerned with the timing of the abatements. That's when city officials clear out a homeless camp. She says official abatement notices went out for 43 camps yesterday. She says in the past, the city issued abatements when there was adequate housing and resources for homeless people.
We are unaware of any adequate shelter capacity to justify the abatement of camps right now.
Bronson spokesman Corey Allen Young said in an email that the administration believes there is adequate shelter space and the city will continue to clear outdoor camps. He said the new shelter and navigation center should be open in late fall. In the interim, he said the city will continue to work with other organizations to provide housing options. St. Mary's Village officials who stayed in their village during a massive tundra fire are working tirelessly to keep their community safe. KYUK's Olivia Eberts has this profile of one of them, St. Mary's School District Superintendent Dee Dee Ivanoff.
Hi. Hi, Olivia. Nice to meet you.
Superintendent Dee Dee Ivanoff steps out of her white pickup truck at the airport. She's here to shuttle fire personnel to the school, where they're sleeping and working out of a makeshift headquarters. She's become one of their main drivers. The road from the airport into town cuts through tundra bathed in smoke. Firefighters dot the roadside. Many are cutting brush away from electric poles so they don't burn. Ivanoff drives past a local crew walking single file.
I mean, you see the fire, but now you see all the crew is just... makes it really real.
As Alaska's largest tundra fire in 15 years has burned behind her home village, Ivanoff has become one of the key organizers for the response effort. She's been liaising between the community and the different responding organizations, overseeing donations and helping with evacuation plans. Ivanoff is the first UPIC superintendent for the St. Mary's School District. She's from the village and moved back during the pandemic to help her aging parents. Then the former superintendent left and the school asked Ivanoff to take the job. I asked her why a school superintendent has ended up helping so much with the fire response.
I feel I have a sense of responsibility for this community. These are my kids. These are my parents.
Plus, the St. Mary's Elementary School has become the hub for fire operations. Logistics has taken over the second grade classroom, planning response operations from tiny chairs. Spokespeople for the responding agencies are in the fifth grade classroom, writing press releases from slightly larger chairs. Beth Ibsen is a spokesperson from the Bureau of Land Management. She said having Superintendent Ivanoff help out made the whole process of getting firefighters and support staff on the ground much smoother.
She's been a huge help, and she's really engaged, and she's wonderful. She has a lot of heart with the kids and with the people there, too.
Self-care has been difficult for Ivanoff during this time.
I'm running on fumes.
She hasn't gotten much sleep, but she's not stopping yet. Her community needs her.
I don't think I have even thought about taking a day off just because the fire is not going to take a day off.
This is true even as the fire's spread has slowed over the past few days. A confluence of good weather has brought firefighters more time to dig defenses around the community. But there's still plenty for Ivanoff to do. Monday, she helped organize a meeting for community members and agencies. She's attending at least two meetings a day with state, local, and federal officials. She's doing all this while taking a class so she can finalize her superintendent certification. Ivanoff is one of many people in the community who are leading local response efforts. She's been working closely with the director of the subregional clinic, the St. Mary's mayor, and her sister. They've all been helping out with evacuations and food and water donations. She calls one of them at the end of a busy day to reflect.
I think we've been working really good as a team, Gail, Scumpy, Mooch, and the coordination has been going well.
Other community members who've stayed in town are helping too. They're cooking food for the firefighters and clearing brush from around buildings. One key task of Ivanoff's is to run the community's communication system. She set up text alerts to let residents know if they'll need to evacuate. Right now, they're on ready status, meaning they should have their belongings ready to go if the fire gets too dangerous. And people are listening to her. Almost everyone I talk to has an evacuation plan. Most plan to leave by boat.
I have the school boats prepared, but not for me. It's for a community.
But what will you do?
I'll just come down here to the dock.
And hop in someone else's boat?
Just stay down here. I'm not leaving.
In St. Mary's, I'm Olivia Eberts.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Poor runs already closed the Kenai River to king salmon fishing this June, and this week the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is closing several other king salmon sport fisheries on the Kenai Peninsula, on the Kisilof and Nanilchik Rivers, as well as in Cook Inlet saltwater. It's all pointing to the downturn of king salmon in Cook Inlet. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
Mike Booz is the Lower Cook Inlet Sport Fish Area Manager for the Department of Fish and Game. He says the department's trying to be proactive in limiting and restricting king fisheries amid that downturn.
I want nothing more than to have good numbers of king salmon returning to our streams every year. But I think it's going to be a test of patience here for what we've been seeing.
King salmon populations have been suffering in Cook Inlet. Boo says the department's been squeaking out escapement goals, but he says the runs haven't supported good fishing or harvest opportunities. He says last week, it was clear the runs were not doing well enough to support sport fisheries.
It was pretty obvious that, you know, these runs are looking to be, you know, some of the weakest runs that we've seen here in Cook Inlet, you know, since we've really been monitoring the escapement.
That's true for both the Kisilof and Nanilchik Rivers, which are stocked with hatchery-produced kings. The Nanilchik River has closed before, most recently in 2018. Babu says it's the first time in his memory the department's also closed the Kisilof to king fishing. And it's all on top of the recent closure of the popular Kenai King early run. For sport fishing guides on the southern Kenai Peninsula, that means rerouting from the king salmon streams on the southern peninsula to the sockeye runs on the central. That's what Grant Anderson with the Fly Box in Anchor Point plans to do, though it comes at a cost for his business.
It's an extra hour drive each direction, and then an hour drive to Kisilof, hour and 10 minutes or so to Kenai.
He says he'll be taking clients up to the Kenai this year, like he has the last several years. Boo says the department will do what it can to restrict the fisheries amid the multi-year downturn of kings. He says that means making timely and conservative management decisions, the need for which he expects to continue going forward.
Ideally, I'd like to see king salmon start turning around right now, but it feels like, you know, we're in for the long haul.
The Kisilof and Cook Inlet saltwater king fisheries close Wednesday. The Nanilchik River closes to king fishing Thursday. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Herring season wrapped up earlier this spring in Sitka Sound with the largest commercial harvest in the history of the Sac Row fishery. Herring management, nevertheless, continues to be controversial and, many would argue, weighted heavily toward market demand in Asia. But what exactly is that market? KCAW's Catherine Rose spoke with a Japanese anthropologist studying the history of herring in his home country and how the market is changing along with the tastes and habits of the Japanese themselves.
Dr. Shingo Hamada is a university professor in Osaka, Japan. He earned his degree in Indiana, studying environmental anthropology and food studies. While a student, Hamada was interested in the history of salmon fishing among indigenous cultures. And during his studies, he met Dr. Thomas Thornton, an anthropologist who has long studied the subsistence herring harvest in Sitka.
He said, "Hey, Shingo, do you know anything about herring fishing in Japan?" And I grew up in a kind of southern part of Japan. So at that time, I didn't know much about herring fishing. So I basically said, well, herring? I don't eat herring much, but on the New Year's Day, I ate kazunoko.
Kazunoko is a delicacy made with herring roe. Hamada and Thornton connected over herring in Japan, and their conversations instilled a curiosity in Hamada.
I mean, my mentor said, you know, I think the production of herring is increasing in Alaska. And I said, the consumption of kazunoko in Japan is decreasing in Japan. So where's the herring go? Yeah, so where's the herring go? And we didn't have any good answers.
Where does the herring go? With that question to answer, Hamada began to research the history of herring fishing in northern Japan and the food systems in place today. Hamada says both fish and the eggs imported from Alaska and Canada are used as food. Some eggs are shipped to Japan after being processed in other countries like China. For the fish and eggs that are processed and sold in Japan, Hamada says the market is waning. Traditionally salted herring eggs, or kazunoko, were eaten on New Year's Day. That tradition is still observed, but the dish doesn't always look like it used to.
Instead of using, for example, kazunoko or shrimp, a lot of people come to prepare roasted beef or grilled chicken.
Rather than trying to revitalize the tradition of herring eggs on New Year's, marketers are instead trying to understand contemporary Japanese consumers. And with some success, they've discovered that flavored herring eggs will sell any time of the year. Typically, salted herring eggs are yellow in color, garnering the nickname Yellow Diamond. But walking down an aisle in a shopping center in Japan today, and you might see herring eggs of different colors.
But nowadays, you know, we see a lot of, kazunoko in brown color, which means they are kind of soaked in the soy sauce base.
Then there's kazuchi. That's herring eggs flavored with processed cheese.
Kazuchi goes well with beer, wine, and sake, and that's a huge hit.
Hamada came to Sitka a few years ago during the herring run and learned about traditional herring subsistence from Tlingit harvesters.
And that technique, the traditional indigenous technique of harvesting herring egg, maintaining a sustainable relationship with herring and human on this, the planet, is just something that I really want to share with the local coastal fishermen in Japan.
Hamada is a candidate for a Fulbright scholarship, and right now he's working with the University of Alaska Southeast, planning to move to Alaska in the spring of 2023 to study spawn on kelp fisheries and further investigate the relationship between our respective cultures and the herring we share. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Claire Strempel in Juneau, Olivia Eberts in Bethel, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, and Catherine Rose in Sitka. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline since 1977, from Prudhoe Bay to the Port of Valdez.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.